do things. I can make things work. But I can't put everything back the way it used to be. Hello and welcome to episode 178 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate stories I've completely forgotten how I do my intro now.
But we're not doing it anymore. Because
it's all over.
I don't think anybody has described either of these films as masterpieces, but we thought they were worth revisiting anyway.
Burn it to the ground. Burn it all to the ground. Because the world has ended, we are doing a few post-apocalyptic films. In fact, we did so many, we can't fit them all in one episode. But let's specifically talk about the 1950s and the end of the world. So this is pre... or at the dawn of the space age, post-atomic age.
Well,
the
first of these is even pre-space age, because Sputnik is 1957.
And our first film that we're going to talk about is 1951.
Yeah.
Which is Five. And this is it's kind of an auteur film in that it was all written and directed and produced by Arch Obola, who I had not heard of before, but he did, he had quite an interesting, background in radio production. He did, some cool stuff, including the radio production of the Chicken Heart that took over the world, which is a story.
Oh, right, I've heard that.
Yes, yeah. So he did this, I've forgotten the radio show that he did before then, but he did a lot of interesting science fiction stuff. He was very into doing anti-Nazi propaganda, but make it clear it was propaganda, sort of pro-Western democracy. Mm. But anyway...
Oh, we should say, by the way, you are Nick.
Oh, yes, I'm Nick, and I am joined, as ever, at the end of the world, by Roger.
Oh, so, yeah, this is... He did not only write, direct and produce this, he provided the major filming location.
Oh, yes, it was his house, wasn't it?
It's the guest house on his ranch, which was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, as is obvious when you look at it. It's either Frank Lloyd Wright or a really good rip-off, and it matches
the original. Someone who is inspired by Frank Lloyd Wright. Yes, it's a very interesting... Well, okay, so the setup of this film...
This film opens... Okay, we're going to come back to this. Roger's nuclear testing corner. Now, I should say, I am not one of those people who can identify every nuclear test just by looking at the footage. I know somebody who can, but I'm not him. On the other hand, this is frankly one of the easiest to spot. It is Crossroads Bikini. It is the second shot of the Operation Crossroads series at Bikini Atoll. And it's a very well-known piece of footage if you're, well, people like me. Sorry.
You are people like you, Roger.
But I think the point is, as far as the audience of the time is concerned, this is probably what they will have seen that will instantly say to them, nuclear bomb. They will not have seen film from Hiroshima.
Yes, yeah. That's fair. It's pretty clear that we're dealing with a nuclear war that has devastated the Earth. Though, as in a lot of these films, which are typically low budget, mysteriously there is very little property damage.
He made it for, I think, $75,000 or something like that. Basically, his entire crew were recent graduates from the University of Southern California Film School. His actors were essentially unknown. They were just actors he liked the look of who didn't have any sort of reputation. It was all done very much on the cheap. And I've got to say, it does not look like a shoestring budget production the way I'm used to them.
The only thing that slightly drew me, I have to say, no, it's got a real kind of... It's clearly not a studio film of the time because it's not staged anything like that. It's much more sort of close-ups and... it's got a real kind of theatrical, well, not quite theatrical, a more realistic feel is what I'm going for. Just the look of it is quite different.
I could see an adaptation to a play working reasonably well without major surgery, yeah.
But the thing that took me out was the bodies, because there are bodies in this one, and they are kind of, even in black and white, slightly grainy film, they look like rubber skeletons to me. But maybe that's...
Okay, I wasn't actually planning a Roger's Forensic Science Corner, but it did occur to me. Skeletons says to me it's at least a month, maybe 2 months, after the mass die-off. if you've got actual skeletonization. What is doing the skeletonization?
What, you think the whole place has been sterilised?
Well, no, that's the thing. They never quite make it clear. There are clearly crops. That growing crops is a major thing of the film. They talk about a few birds, but no other animals. I feel that you're going to get a certain amount of food chain collapse, frankly.
Yes, I think that's fair. Maybe the bacteria done it all from the inside out, but that's quite a stretch.
And to be fair, they didn't know at the time, but it turns out birds actually do have a higher radiation tolerance than many other sorts of animal, as was discovered after Chernobyl.
Yes. I'm surprised that all, and because there's no kind of nuclear winter here either, but this was probably pre fully developed ideas of nuclear winter.
Yeah, I think that does come rather later. Yeah.
That science, partially from watching these films, the whole idea of a nuclear winter, or at least the severity of a nuclear winter as we see in, say, Threads, is perhaps a bit overblown, which is slightly reassuring to me, given the kind of 2025 we've had.
Well, anyway. It's basically predicated on debris, isn't it? Urban firestorms, stuff kicked up by the
I think what
attack.
You'd need is a lot of ground bursts in a lot of areas that would produce a lot of debris. And to be honest, most nuclear bombs would be airbursts, even by the time of this, and just wouldn't kick up as much dust as is properly supposed. But anyway, that's slightly different there. But you're right, yes. It's kind of very much the worst case scenario of everything burning and everything landing on the ground.
In any case, at this point, they definitely haven't heard of it. The original study is 1952, and that says we looked at whether it could happen, and clearly it wouldn't. So we're fine. And it's only in 57 that they start saying, well, actually, it might be a concern. But anyway, talking about the skeletons and so on, is what we have is a young woman clearly in a state of shock, going somewhere. For some reason, she doesn't know where she's aiming for or why. Well, she has a vague idea. She knows that the place she's going to exists.
Yes.
That was why I was concerned about the skeletons, because it's been 4 weeks at least to get skeletons, and humans do not stay in a state of shock for 4 weeks.
Well, we find out later it's relatively soon after the apocalypse. anyway, I guess it's... It's cheaper to show a skeleton, and two, it's less gruesome, frankly, than a rotting corpse.
Yes.
So I
will agree with you and expand that in general, there should be a whole lot more bodies, whether they're skeletons or not.
Well, we're talking about, I mean, at this time, was the population 5 billion or something like that? But
yeah, but she's going through a small town.
Yes. Yeah. There should be thousands. The film is called Five, and it's called Five because these are the last five people on Earth. Probably
not
we find
time.
Out later. Yeah, well, I think they do briefly. They're all in one scene, just about, technically. Yes. So this is Roseanne, who heads to, trudging sort of from place to place and finds a house. And then she hears... bells, church bells, and she thinks that means there's someone alive, and she heads into a house, and collapses at, is it Michael? Michael's feet, the other man, in the house.
William Phipps, who wears his beard like a man who's not used to wearing a beard. Which is not surprising, because it's the 50s, and if you look the guy up, you know, every other publicity shot of him you could find, he's clean shaven. So...
He's, well, it's interesting. He has a kind of a look here of a more like 60s, 70s character. But yes, he's like a 50s, it doesn't look like stubble that's grown out, does it? It looks like a beard that's been stuck on. It's what it looks like.
He is one of them beatniks, clearly.
he does have a beatnik look to him. Roseanne collapses, Michael, because she's basically run out, because she's a woman, she's run out of any kind of mental fortitude that she had, because this is the 50s.
But she's also come on foot from the city.
She has, yes.
Wherever that may be. It's clearly some way away.
And Michael, yeah, I think we're somewhere, New York is mentioned a few times, so I think we're somewhere around there. And then Michael has been sort of setting up the house a little bit. He thought he was the only person alive, and now there's two of them.
I think it is technically her, either hers or her. She can be reasonably considered to be the owner at this point, with everybody else dead at any rate.
I think, yeah, she knew it from her childhood or...
something.
Yes, yes, it's either way around.
And Michael had simply seen it and thought it looked nice.
It is a nice-looking house, definitely. Distinctive. It's hard to get an idea of the geography of the house because it's such a... an interesting architectural structure.
Yeah, I confess, because my first thought was, that's a very defensible location, but this never comes into play, so fair enough.
Yes, it's up on a hill, and has great looks, viewpoints over the sea, and down onto the land, and the only road approaching it.
But anyway, for the moment, it's two.
Yes, now we're two. She is again, because she's a 50s lady, she is mute for some time. Again, it's reasonable. It's just a shame that it is the only female in the film that is behaving in this way. But she does come out of it eventually. They start talking. We learn a little about their background. I'm not sure if it's here that we find out that she was having an x-ray. So she was in a lead-lined room, which protected her at least from the radiation, which seems to have finished everyone else off.
The neutron bomb has not been invented yet, but this matches the public image as opposed to the reality of the way neutron bombs might actually work.
Yes, the idea of a neutron bomb being that it let out a ton of neutrons, which killed everything living but didn't do a lot of property damage other than when it hit the ground, which is not quite how a neutron bomb would work.
It's not even how neutrons work, but yeah.
Exactly.
This is not by my book, but hey, guys, buy my book.
That said, it's a very cheap way of doing it without having to show the devastation of a nuclear apocalypse. But they never mention any of that. Other than it seems to be radiation that's killed everyone. She survived because she was in a lead-lined box. Michael was in a lift.
Yeah, he was a tour guide on the Empire State Building.
Yes, and whether that was lead-lined or not, it's not clear. He doesn't know quite why he's still alive and no one else is, but it's possible there was some protection in that thing. Anyway, they get along, they're quite tense. Michael, at one point, basically attempts to rape her, which I found pretty tricky to deal with for the rest of the film.
He's being presented as basically a good and friendly guy, but he simply assumes that I'm a man, you're a woman, I can take what I want.
Yes.
Some of this may be distance, of course, and it does seem to have been an assumption in the 50s that that kind of thing was going to happen. You wouldn't leave a man and a woman alone, unchaperoned.
I mean, it's not presented as a good thing, but it's not the kind of "I'm not going near that man ever again" kind of thing that maybe to modernise.
She makes it clear that she's not a prude, but she is pregnant and her husband is possibly still alive.
Yes.
This is the point at which I was thinking, well, nobody really has any ideas beyond the immediate survival consideration. You know, Michael is thinking, at some point we ought to get to cultivation, but for the moment we have plenty of food. He has no particular plans for the future. All she is thinking is, I must find out what happened to my husband.
Yes.
As we later discover, he was in the next room when she was having the x-ray, and she didn't check when she was right there.
That I found a little... We'll come on to that, but yes, that is a little frustrating. I mean, and presumably he was there and dead, because he's still there when she goes back later.
Mm.
So, did she just scream and run out and then... I don't know. I guess she couldn't send him a text or something, so...
I suppose we have to assume that she was just in such a panic that she ran and ran, and then by the time she came to herself, she couldn't run back or... something.
I think that's fair. That's probably the way that makes sense of it. I mean, I am on board with it. I do love these kind of tense stories. I there's something about end of the world and post-apocalyptic that I'm very on board with. I don't know if that's just the spirit of the times, but I would like to see a bit more, like, as you say, this is the situation we're in. And one of the films we watched, one of the characters is very on board with that when we talk about panic in Year Zero. But we don't get a lot of it here. That'll probably be next episode now I think about it. But at this point, while they're just sort of continuing, as you say, without any plans, we then become four because we get Mr. Barnstable and Charles arriving.
So they basically they got accidentally locked in a bank vault. Barnstable is some sort of senior clerk or bookkeeper or something of that sort, and Charles was, I think, a security guard or some menial task at the bank anyway.
The doorman. So Charles is black and consequently is unlikely to have any position of any consequence in the bank. And again, we start to see some of the 50s in this film, as in some of the others we look at. We see some of the very much on the forefront of the 50s mindset, you know, the kind of racial tension, which of course haven't gone away, but they're presented in such a way to slightly jarring to modern sensibilities, because the characters are kind of modern in a lot of ways.
Well,
but
that's
the
thing.
React to race is a bit...
Yeah, a nasty racist can be a nasty racist, and you expect them to be a nasty racist, but what we have here is these white people who are just casually assuming that, but obviously the black guy's going to do all the physical labour.
Yes.
To be fair, most of them don't do a whole lot of that, and Oliver the bank clerk he's basically in denial. Yeah, he is treating it as if it were a vacation.
Yes.
He's clearly not very well.
He's not well. Charles is very... They all get on well. And actually, the arrival of these two change the dynamic and relieve a lot of the tensions between Michael and Roseanne. And so they do decide to make some plans between Charles and Michael. Michael obsessively kind of repairing the roof... I'm sure there are houses that have better roofs, but he seems to find some solace in it. But Charles helps him with that. But then they decide to cultivate some corn on the cob. And so they get to work doing that. Roseanne is getting pretty heavily pregnant by this point. So I think has a reasonable excuse as to why she's not doing a lot of the labour. And Mr. Barnstable, Oliver, is not well enough to do a lot. But
yeah, he becomes ill. He recovers a bit and says, "I would really like to go to the beach," and so they do.
Then we have Chekhov's radiation poisoning because we see that, as will become important later in the film, Oliver is has got some subcutaneous hemorrhage. He's showing signs of acute radiation poisoning. I don't know; it seems to be chronic, but anyway, it's not quite at radiation poisoning. You do get worse and then get better and then get a lot worse again, but over the kind of time scale, I don't know.
But the most obvious thing with a fatal dose tends to be the diarrhea and vomiting, to be fair.
Yes, yeah.
Which and it's the 50s, they can't show that.
Yes, and it can stretch out over a long period, but yes, it wouldn't normally be just the subcutaneous bleeding. But
yeah,
anyway.
This is in my book. I'm going to have to link the book in the show notes.
I really think you should. There's a lot of information, because almost all our apocalypses are nuclear. I think all of them we're going to talk about, in fact, because it was very much on the mind in the 50s. So Charles, they take him to the beach. And speaking of nasty racists, a man washes up on the beach. And this is Michael, a man
Eric.
This is Eric, a man of indeterminate foreignness that I couldn't quite work out. Was he supposed to be French or German? He's a white European fellow.
Yeah,
James
Anderson, the actor, was mostly took parts in cowboy films. Yeah, that's the work that was. I don't know what that accent is meant to be. It could be French.
I think I'd go with French, but turns out he was up on Everest when it happened, came back down and found the world had ended. Stole a plane, started flying all around.
Learned to
fly. I mean, he's quite the Renaissance man, Eric. And for a very brief, I don't know, 5 seconds of the film, we are five. I'd take six if you count the unborn baby.
Well, yeah. Oliver has died by the time they get back to him from pulling Eric out of the sea.
But he was technically alive when they were going to get him out. So I'm counting that as five alive at one time. But yes, by the time they get back to, they pull Michael out. He's, was he on a boat or was he flying?
I think he's crashed his plane and is now just loose in the sea.
I got the spectacular good fortune to wash up on the beach, where the four remaining people on the planet are. Again, it is suggested, in fact, shown that there are other people alive, but still. Greatly denuded population, but he does get rescued.
And we're not going to meet any of them. We have a cast of five in this film.
We have a cast of five. And I suppose technically, Oliver has died of radiation poisoning by the time he had a brief regression to the mean, as they call it, where he felt a bit better, but then he died. And Eric, again, what I like about this film is that it didn't drag for me because it's the shifting dynamic, you know, that we have as each person gets added, it really pulls the dynamic in different directions. And Eric is a much more go-getter. He doesn't understand why they're pissing about with crops when there's
loot
all
the
this
cities.
Stuff. Yeah, let's go back to the cities, loot all the cities. Michael, okay, we got the two white guys. Basically, the contrasting leaders, really, because they would be. Michael is much more wary because the city's where all the bad things happen, and he's worried they're dangerous. Eric is like, well, there's food, there's jewels, everything we want. Let's go back to the cities. Both of them start competing for Roseanne's affection. Again, Charles is not in the running here because he's a black man. But it turns out that Eric is a nasty racist and just basically comes out and says it. I find you unpleasant because of your race and your colour. I think even for the characters in the film, it's a bit of a shock for them that he's just quite so blatantly racist and horrible.
Yeah, I think it's not explicitly stated, but there's been a certain undertone of, well, you know, we might not actually have liked each other back in the world, but we are what there is. We've got to get on together because we're what there is.
Yes, exactly. And yes, no one comes out and says, oh, none of that matters anymore. But yeah, it's kind of implied that that's what's going on. But that is not Eric's point of view. There are white people and there are other people, and he's one of the white, and he doesn't want to deal with anyone else, especially not now all bets are off because the world has ended. So he begins going off in the one jeep that they have and picking up stuff.
Charles and Eric get into a fight, which is interrupted by Roseanne tactically going into labour.
Oh yes, the baby is born. Well, that's it. We have the baby now to deal with. And that means kind of Roseanne is kind of back on the market again, particularly. Eric is very keen on them all going back to the city. Charles refuses.
Eric gets to the point of driving the jeep through the proto-cultivated field. So now you'll have to go back to the city.
Yes, and says he did it kind of by accident. He reveals that he has a gun.
And yeah, Michael tries to throw him out and fails because he has a gun.
Because Eric just points a gun at him and says, I'll go whenever I like. Then Eric convinces Roseanne to come with him to the city to check whether her husband is still alive.
Which is the thing that she has been saying she wants to do all this time.
She does want to go back to the city and just on the off chance there are people there alive. Eric postulates that they are in some way immune or at least inherently resistant to the radiation, so they'll probably be safe. Otherwise, they would be dead already.
There is an obvious counter argument that nobody makes here, which is, you know, I was in the elevator, she was in the X-ray room. We all have a reason. You know, you guys were in the bank vault. We all have a reason
you
why.
You were at Everest.
But nobody thinks to argue that with Eric, and in fact, it probably wouldn't work anyway.
It wouldn't, and it may be they're thinking it, but it just seems a bit pointless to talk it through with Eric, who is unreasonable. Regardless, he hoodwinks Roseanne to come with him when Charles...
He gives her the impression in the middle of the night that, yeah, it's all fine, we're just going to go and then we'll come back and it'll be fine.
Yes.
He has, I think he's already killed Charles by this point, well, in the process of loading up the Jeep.
Charles realises he's going away for a long time. He doesn't really get fully what's going on, but he's about to. He's about to understand that Eric is about to abduct Roseanne, or at least cause some problems. But before he puts two and two together, Eric has stabbed him in the back and killed him. So they hive off to the city.
Roger's fuel storage corner. This does actually work, but it wouldn't work in the modern day. Unleaded petrol lasts about 6 months, but this is the 50s. Lead, baby. And that will last up to 3 years if you store it right.
Oh, well, there we go. They're fine.
The siren is still sounding in the city.
Yes, yeah.
Now, it's very atmospheric, and I agree. No. I tend to think of sirens as being a thing that runs on central power, but I did some research on this, and particularly in the States, where you've got, say, a small town that needs a tornado warning siren or something like that, what you actually tend to do is hook it up to a V8 engine.
Okay. But that would have run out of fuel.
Have run out of fuel, yeah, because why would you put 6 months' worth of fuel in the tank?
We presume it. I mean, it's been long enough for corn on the cob to grow.
Yeah, they don't actually name any times, but it's certainly not months. The week or so that we could see from the incidents.
I liked it, though, because it adds this kind of tension and eeriness to the city, that the minute they're in the city, the siren's off all the time, mm-hmm. It feels tense, it feels stressful. Eric's kind of happy, but...
He can take all the stuff he wants.
Exactly, but Roseanne is tense and on edge. It adds this kind of nastiness to the cities. It just feels dangerous. And it turns out it is dangerous. So Roseanne goes in
She has the baby with her, we should say.
She has the baby with her, very important. Because she still thinks they're about to head back. She goes into the hospital where she survived. I think she goes to his office. He's an architect. She goes to his office. He's not there. So she goes to the hospital where she was having the x-ray, has a look in the waiting room, and there he is, where she left him.
Conveniently unscavenged.
Conveniently unscavenged. She knows it's him. He's dead. So she wants to go back now. Eric has other ideas. Eric never intended to take her back. She's his now. She's his possession. He's got a load of jewels. God knows what he's going to do with those in the post-apocalyptic.
Eat them.
he's very happy. But at this moment, the Chekhov's radiation poisoning trigger is pulled because it's revealed that Eric was indeed not immune to radiation and is showing significant signs of radiation poisoning. Now, whether that's something that would have happened all the time or whether it's because they got back to the city, I think it's implied because they went back to the city. It could be.
I don't think it really specifies one way or the other.
And he runs off in a panic, disappears, and Roseanne... presumably he's got the keys to the Land Rover, I don't know, but Roseanne takes a baby and starts walking back all the way she went.
Okay, this is at least consistent. You know, she didn't hotwire a car the first time she ran away. Yeah. She isn't hotwiring a car this time.
But this time she has a baby, and it's a long... Michael doesn't sort of... I mean, probably wisely, there's no way he would have caught up. He hasn't got a car, he couldn't have done anything, but he just sort of doesn't try... He doesn't know for sure where they're going, but he must have a fair idea.
He does do a bit of searching. I mean, yeah, okay, so she's walking back along the way the baby dies because, you know, maximum tragedy and so on.
I found that a bit... I wasn't sure that was going to happen. I thought they'd... But, yeah, that was a bit rough. That was a bit Threads-esque to me that the baby popped it. Presumably from a combination of starvation and radiation poisoning, but it doesn't survive.
Yeah, I mean, she can't be in great health. She's having to scavenge her food for a start.
Yes. And it's a long... Again, we're not sure how long, but it's...
It's at least one overnight trip on foot.
Yes, yeah.
But Michael does eventually find her. They bury the kid and return to the house.
And they've... At this point, they've had some kind of burgeoning romance.
Maybe.
His past sins are forgiven, and... He'd kind of said that he loves her and he's sorry what he tried, and she is very taciturn, but kind of implies that she'd be happy.
Also,
but
she does now know that she is a widow, so that removes the last possible objection to their relationship.
Yeah, well, of course, yes, he couldn't possibly have any other. I mean, he is technically the last man on Earth, but that doesn't mean she has to. Anyway, they then sort of head back to the house and begin to build their... whatever their life is going to be together. Presumably they'll get back to the crops.
The closing shot is that they are tilling the fields together.
Yes. I mean, I like this one. It has some logic flawed. Really what it is an excuse to have these five characters bounce off each other, which is a lot of these post-apocalyptic films.
Yeah, and the thing I liked absolutely, I have criticised things, I will criticise more things, but I really liked the acting here.
Yes, yeah, they're all really, they're not, it's an acting style that's quite naturalistic, and just, I don't know, it worked. Yeah, I agree, they're all really good in their roles. You know, I like it when films are like, they refer to them by the first character names. I don't know why, but it makes you feel closer to them. I had some issues with the film, and it isn't a masterpiece for a number of reasons, but I did, I really enjoyed it. I was surprised to find it was basically, as you say, it could very easily have been a play, with a backdrop, and just a couple of sets really. But it is this kind of dynamic of these characters bouncing off each other and how the dynamic changes as each new character enters, Charles and Oliver and the baby and then Eric. I enjoyed it. I'm not sure that I really... The only character I really warmed to particularly was Charles, I must say. The others are less warmable too, but I did like Michael and Roseanne. By the end I had to get over the rape scene, or the attempted rape scene with Michael, but I did enjoy it.
Yeah, a contemporary review from Bosley Crowther, these people are such a wretched crew that the skeptic is well provoked to wonder whether it wouldn't be better if everyone were killed.
that is harsh.
I don't think it's entirely fair. I'm not always convinced by the plot, but as I say, I like the acting, I like the people.
Yes, it carried me along, it didn't outstay its welcome, and for a post-apocalyptic film of people, I don't know, for my taste there wasn't enough worrying about how they were actually going to live. But there was echoes of that with Eric basically saying, what are you doing? Let's just go to the city and loot it.
Yeah, and Crowther went on, I think, to say a bit more fairly that it's a unique situation, but they're not doing unique things. They might as well be five castaways on a desert island.
Yes,
in terms of the pressures on them.
That is fair, but I think that is, I don't know, maybe that is how humans would react in that sort of situation. You've got to live day by day, haven't you? That's what I like about post-apocalyptic. It does open these sort of questions about how people behave. They are themselves, but more extreme versions, I think, particularly Eric.
Well, I've heard it suggested that that's basically the key of a soap opera. You're taking these people and then putting them in an extreme situation. My husband has betrayed me, my daughter is doing drugs, whatever. But you're constantly bringing up extreme situations to show people's true personalities.
Well, that, I mean, I'm not against soap opera. I like soap
opera. Oh, yeah, I'm not saying this is a bad thing. I'm saying that this is how it works. That's why it has an appeal.
Well, that's the essence of drama, isn't it? That you make characters you care about and then you put them through hell. It's kind of literally what happens in post-apocalyptic fiction. I enjoyed it. It wasn't my favourite. I'm glad I watched it. But let's move on to the related, The World, the Flesh and the Devil. So this is 8 years later.
Yeah, it's 1959.
Harry Belafonte, who I had no idea had an acting career.
Similarly, he's about the height of it here. He can pretty much pick and choose the parts he wants, and he specifically wanted to do this film for reasons that we'll come back to. I should just say the title is a medieval thing, and basically these are the challenges to a good Christian. The temptations of the world, the temptations of the flesh, and the temptations of the devil.
Okay, well, I found the title intriguing. I'm not sure it quite lives up to it, but it's interesting. It's an interesting contrast because it's a similar setup. We'll talk about it more specifically, but the plot is basically these are the last people on Earth, and how do they bounce off each other? Here I find it... a little more forced and a little unusual. Mm. But that's no... again, the acting's very good. So we start with Ralph Burton, Harry Belafonte.
Who's a mine inspector.
He's a mine inspector. Somewhere down in... somewhere on the East Coast or near the East Coast. I'm not quite sure where.
Yeah, Wikipedia says Pennsylvania, but I don't remember that specifically being mentioned in the film. It's somewhere, you know, not a million miles from New York, as we will find out later.
Yes, that's the important bit. He is down inspecting a mine. I was really shocked to see Harry Belafonte. He's a really good actor. Mm. Incredibly short trousers for some reason, but there we go. While he is down inspecting the mine, the apocalypse happens. And again, it's a...
Though nobody tells him. I mean, this is an interesting thing, because it's varied over the years, but with a lot of these things, you know, everybody knows that there might be something coming. You know, there are a few weeks of escalating tension. In this case, he's just doing his job normally, and nobody seems to think it's...
There's no indication
that he's doing that. And then there is a sudden cave-in.
Now, I don't think that is related to the apocalypse. I think that just happens to be a cave-in, because there seems to be some attempt to rescue him. Again, it's not clear. He doesn't know. He's in the cave.
Well, we can rebuild some of this, but we'll come back to that later. But yeah, there is a cave-in that he can hear people digging towards him. You know, he taps on the rock and they tap back and things like that.
He does a bit of singing, because he's Harry Belafonte, and you should get him to sing. And again, I love his singing voice, so I'm not unhappy.
But after 5 days, the sounds of digging stop, and so do the drainage pumps.
Yes. Now, whether that is... it's clear to him the escape attempt has completely stopped, and if he doesn't get out, he's going to drown.
If anyone's going to rescue him, it's going to be him.
So he does, in desperation, manage to... Because there has been enough of a rescue attempt to get quite close to him, he just has to sort of dig a little way to get to the tunnel that they were digging, I think, is what happened. He digs himself out and gets above ground.
And very unusual thing, just I noticed from the effects point of view, a lot of the time when the film shows flooding, they will use basically water. Because, you know, nobody wants to get mucky and so on, but this is clearly dirty water, and yeah, it's coming off on his costume and on his skin. And
yeah, it's
unusual for a film to go to that level of detail.
The claustrophobia of that opening, really won me over that opening scene. It's just really, as you say, very brackish, very oily, kind of horrible water. It is hell that he's trapped in, and he's already been trapped there for some time. He makes it out to find there is literally no one. And this film doesn't even bother with bodies or rubber skeletons. There's no bodies anywhere. I don't know whether they all disintegrated or, as you suggested, got ill enough to just bury themselves right at the last. But there is not a corpse to be found, as far as I can tell. I mean, you would have thought it'd be pretty whiffy up there and full of... I don't know if all the animals... This seems to be a common thing, that all the animals have also died, but you would have thought there'd be some vultures or something. But no, it's just an empty city or town that he finds himself in.
And this is actually relevant, because his immediate thought is, I will go to New York.
Mm.
And one consideration of the real world would be an awful lot of unburied bodies and rats and plague and like that.
One of the least sanitized, I mean, New York's already got some sanitation problems currently, but post-apocalyptic, it's probably not great. But it's not an issue. He gets a car. It seems to have come as a bit of a surprise to everyone. It's implied that it hasn't been, again, it's something like a neutron bomb or radiation poisoning that has killed everyone, rather than a thermonuclear war.
Well, they do say specifically. We'll come back to that when he finds out about what's going on.
When he gets the radio station.
But I do very much like the. You know, he goes to the civil defence. Civil defence ain't going to help you. They're all gone and dead. He goes to the church. Church ain't going to help you. They're all gone and dead. It's perhaps obvious, but it's nicely shown.
Yes, yeah, it's he's on his own.
And I was meanwhile saying, you don't turn down a free bicycle. Way more use than the car.
Absolutely, but no, he takes a car. Now, Ralph is, as well as being a mine inspector. He is clearly was an engineer on his way up, or it's certainly he's very good at fixing things and with electronics, or not really electronics in the '50s, I suppose, but he's very good with electrics. And so he heads to New York to find everyone's gone there as well. He wanders around. The scenes dragged a little bit. There's a lot of scenes of him wandering around.
But they do look beautiful, I've got to say.
They do. It's they're lovely scenes. I just feel they were so happy with them that they played a lot of them. So there's quite some time where he wanders around. Eventually, he... Does he hear something and go into the radio station? I'm not sure. But he heads into a radio station, and there he finds recordings of... basically what happened, which is a poisonous dust cloud of radioactive isotopes.
Yeah, so this is an actual thing that was proposed. Basically, sodium-24 has a half-life of about 13 hours.
Right.
And you can't coat a bomb with that, but you can coat a bomb with something that will be transformed to sodium-24 when the bomb goes off.
Right.
And this was a genuine proposal for a salted bomb. Basically, it isn't just that the bomb destroys stuff, it's that it makes the area uninhabitable for a matter of days.
A short period of time, yeah.
And then the follow-up invasion can happen.
So in the time that Ralph was trapped down in the mine, all these isotopes have decayed to harmless substances, and which is why he's absolutely fine.
This is why it is not a much shorter film.
It doesn't explain where all the bodies went, but fine. But that's what's happened. It seems to have covered the entire globe. Again, as with these things, they escalated beyond what they meant to. And as far as we know, the entire globe has been in this situation. And so the entire population of Earth has been poisoned.
There is a hint later on of a possible contact, but yeah.
Yeah, as with Five... There probably are other people. In fact, there are suggestions there are other people alive. But
now, after this point, I was really loving this film.
Yeah, I was Ralph. I mean, Harry Belafonte is very good company. He's an interesting character, and some of his character
remembering Paris, Texas. It's a similar thing of the guy walking across the abandoned landscapes, and I similarly enjoyed it because it's a really solid actor at the middle of it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And he's, but we don't know much about him. And it's interesting. He's clearly an optimist. And he's clearly a man, of action in the sense that he doesn't just want to sit about. He, immediately sort of gets about once he realizes he's on his own. He starts to sort of build things together. He picks up, some mannequins that become his friends. Just to have someone to bounce off. But then it turns out there've been some suggestions someone's following him, and then he finds Sarah, who has been following him, a fellow survivor it comes about because he gets so sick of the mannequin that he throws it out the window, and she thinks he's jumped out the window, so she has a panic. Again, a nice touch, and then we have... The dynamic shifts again. Ralph and Sarah are together. So Ralph is a black man. Sarah is a white woman. And for some reason, this becomes massively important, even though the apocalypse has happened.
Well, I think the idea is that it's 1959 and both of these people were in the mindset of their era before the apocalypse, and they're not instantly going to drop it now.
Yes.
But yeah, she is casually saying, oh, well, there's nobody to marry. While Harry is right there.
Yeah, exactly. So he, I think he's the kind of person who is happier with machines than with people. And you get that impression. He is a little awkward. They do have a, you know, he sets up the electricity, he sets up a phone line, but he doesn't sort of forbid her living in his building, but he makes it pretty clear he's sort of happier on his own, even though he sort of isn't happier. And then we get into the sort of race politics that he's just uncomfortable. She said a few things that are casually racist, and he has taken that very strongly.
Well, this is the same thing I'm talking about earlier. It's much more impressive when it is a character who is basically sympathetic and yet who has these attitudes simply because they haven't thought about them.
Yes, exactly. And it's well done here. And I can see what Harry Belafonte, who was very active in the, he's still alive, you know, I think Harry Belafonte.
Yeah, but I believe this part of it was one of the main reasons why he wanted to do this film.
Yes. Because it becomes, well, it becomes a plot. It just, this is where it feels a little forced to me, because I just, these are two intelligent, sympathetic people. And yes, she's casually racist, and he is, he's also racist in his own way, in that he's making a lot of assumptions about her that aren't necessarily true. I just feel they would have got over that a bit more quickly, but Ralph is, and Sarah gives a lot of indication that she is willing, you know, to, she's willing to have a relationship, you know, that she's keen, she's interested, she likes him. But Ralph keeps sort of coming back to this, it can't happen. So I found that a bit, the politics I found a bit forced in there. I and again, it's easy for me to say, not being a black man from the 1950s.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I'm absolutely not going to claim that racism has been solved. I mean, we did that in the 90s, obviously. but the racism that I have observed in my life has never looked like this.
Yes.
So the film may well have had something to say to people at the time, but it doesn't really have stuff to say to me.
Yes, this is much more like, these are people from two different classes, and they can, it's more like, it feels like more of a sort of a Japanese style caste thing, that this is just a line you cannot cross, whereas to us, that, you know, those lines have been crossed and repeatedly have, and it's not really, you know, interracial relationships. I mean, this is some time before the first black and white screen kiss, which I think was Star Trek, wasn't it?
I think it was not quite, but very nearly.
But that was under some alien influence as well. but yeah, so I knew that wasn't going to happen. But it just felt a bit forced. Now, I don't know whether did the motion picture code specifically forbid interracial?
Probably.
Yeah, it probably did. So it may be that they couldn't have a relationship, which it felt a bit odd that Ralph just kept coming back to the fact that it couldn't happen. Anyway, for very specific racial reasons, Ralph keeps rebuffing Sarah, who is interested. She has a whole birthday party, and he puts on some music and they have a lovely time. But then they bounce off this fact that he has a bit of a racial chip on his shoulder. Again, understandably, given the 50s. But
bearing in mind that in his life before the war, if he had made a move, he would probably have been beaten to death by the local white boys. I mean, it was at least a possibility.
That is not something you get rid of easily. So that's a very good reminder for me that you know, he's literally had to be careful his whole life for fear of his life. But then we get Ben turning up. Ben is, he arrives on a boat in New York Harbor. He's been around everywhere. Everyone else is dead. It's not quite clear how Ben and Sarah survived. I'm not sure we ever really find out, but it doesn't matter. For whatever reason, they survived the poison as well.
Well, my headcanon for Sarah, you remember the Day of the Triffids?
Yes.
The woman survives not having her eyes burned out by the comet by virtue of having a really bad hangover and staying in bed all day.
Yes, as opposed to being in an eye hospital. Mm. Yeah, okay, yes, I'd forgotten that. Yeah, so she does seem the type. And when Ben arrives again, we get a shift in the dynamics. This is when it really stretches sort of credulity to me.
So Ralph is deliberately trying to step back and encourage them to get together.
Yes, but Sarah is still clearly prefers Ralph to Ben. Ben is,
She might decide she didn't want either of them. Those aren't really distinguished in Ben's mind.
Well, Ben is very much more like Michael, isn't he, really? You know, we're the two eligible people in the world. So, you know, obviously you're mine. He never got, it's all a bit more civilized here. It never quite gets to attempted rape, but not far off on Ben's point. From Ben's point,
also nobody ever actually sits down and has a discussion of, you know, are we just going to live well till we die, or are we going to try to repopulate the world?
Which
I feel that, you know, Sarah ought to have a say in.
Yes, exactly. There's no kind of forward planning here. Ralph is trying to kind of improve, but again, that can only ever be a temporary thing, really, what he's doing with his quality of life improvements. But then it goes, not so really, because then Ben gets a gun. I mean, he has kind of wanted to get rid of Ben. Like, as soon as they rescue Ben, like, they start to think, oh, should we have done this? Is this going to go wrong? Like, before he's even conscious, basically.
Can we just drop him back in the harbour, maybe?
Yeah. But then turns out they were right, because Ben goes nutsoid, really. He gets a revolver, and then he gets a sniper rifle. And
as far as he's concerned, Ralph is the obstruction in the way of his happiness with Sarah.
Yeah, so he wants to engineer this situation where they're in conflict. Ralph is not going to play this game. He just tries to avoid him. He gets a rifle, but he doesn't really go and shoot. Ben is shooting from the rooftops, trying to kill him. Eventually, Ralph is like, oh, fuck this. Drops the rifle and,
he sees a significant memorial. The quote from Isaiah outside United Nations headquarters, they shall beat their swords into plowshares and all that stuff.
Yes, so he suddenly thinks, oh, we're going back to war and all the things that killed us before. Or that's the implication. Drops his rifle, gives up. And Ben can't shoot him. So he also, I don't know whether he drops his rifle... but he heads off, is presumably banished from the trio. But then they all sort of walk into the sunset, happily ever after.
Well, specifically Sarah goes to, forces Ralph to take her hand, and then gets Ben and forces him to take her other hand. And in other words, yeah, the woman gets to do all the emotional labour of making this community work.
Yeah, which does seem realistic.
And because we can't even suggest what might be going to happen after that, that's the end of the film, but they're all walking off together, as you say.
I loved this film when it was just Harry Belafonte. I was a little confused when Sarah... I liked it, and I felt it was kind of realistic. It was just an unusual... When Ben turns out, I just felt like it... went out. These people are just behaving in ways that I know they're under a lot of pressures, a lot of unusual things. I just didn't quite understand why this was the form. Rather than what are we going to eat, what are we going to do for the rest of our lives, this love triangle became the foremost thing in the story. Mm. Now I can see why Harry Belafonte, there is a lot to say about race and the pointlessness of racism.
Well, also, just, you know, his production company, Harbell Productions, was specifically set up by him to do realistic portrayals of African-American life and so on, rather than the parody that was often in film before that.
Which is great. And I was looking into Harry Belafonte for that. He's a saint, that guy. I mean, he gave back to his community and the amount he's done. I say was, again, I think he's still alive. Oh no, 2023 he died. So, he was just an incredible guy, incredible singer, a great actor here, and just really interested, of course, in racial politics, and just a really nice guy. But so very watchable. But when Ben turns up, for me, the film just kind of contorts itself to kind of have its cake and eat it. It wants this racial conflict, but it doesn't want them to kill each other, and it's got to have this kind of happy ending. Whether that's motion picture code related, I don't know.
I'm sure we couldn't imply a three-way relationship in 1959, especially not an interracial one.
Especially, I'm not sure. It just felt a bit too constrained by the mores of its time and a bit too obsessed.
It's very author's message.
Yeah, yeah. And
it's a shame, because... As you say, I love Belafonte's acting. I quite like what the others are doing, but
yes,
they are forced into this very specific. Yeah, okay, you're getting your message across, and I understand that, and to some extent I respect it, but it doesn't make it as enjoyable as the first part was to me.
Yes, I agree. It doesn't feel like it. It's a message film to the detriment of the plot and the characters, I think. But I enjoyed it very much. I think I preferred 5 to this one, though. I'm very glad I watched it as well. I had no idea Harry Belafonte had done anything like this. I was surprised, but very pleased.
Yeah, I was just thinking of him as, oh yeah, that Calypso guy.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So I'm glad it got me looking into his history a bit. But there we are, a couple of 50s end of the world stories, both quite similar. Both had their flaws, but I enjoyed both of them.
Both clearly very strongly felt by somebody involved in production.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Artie Obler in the first one and Harry Belafonte probably in the second. Lovely stuff. Anyway, we have more 50s post-apocalyptic films to talk about, but for now, this is the end of the episode.